Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Food for the Soul podcast on the Solaire Report. I am joined by Nina Hein, the author of Food for the Soul, and Ulrike Groninger, who is our future science host, but a great art admirer as well. And I'm Catherine Austin Fitz, and we are still enjoying the high of the trip to the Barnes Foundation. So, Nina, tell us what happened.
Hello. So what happened was that the three of us have had the chance to enjoy Barnes Foundation in Philadelphia, and we are now sharing our experiences and favorites, and we want to talk about various paintings that are at that place. The occasion for it is because the same way that we had a few years back a year of Da Vinci celebrating the artist's anniversary by going to various museums all over Europe. We were in Paris, we were in Milan, and talk about various paintings and his life and what it means to the contemporary life, if you like.
The last time the three of us did a podcast, we were sitting in an amazing apartment in Paris talking about Da Vinci.
Exactly.
And we were high from that visit.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we're kind of repeating the experience this year when we have themed it Women in Art. One of the elements of this theme is the book that I have written that is coming out this year, published by Solari. So that will be Solari premiere of an art book. The book will be entitled, indeed, Women in Art, Artists, Models, and Those Who Made It Happen. This is the title of the book, sometime later this year, but this is also the theme of everything that we write about and look at this year in terms of art.
And if I can just chime in here, Nina has a hard time talking about her own book as the
author. It's beautiful.
And it is so beautiful.
Yeah.
Everybody will just love this book.
Yes.
Yes.
It collects up many of the columns that you've written for Food for the Soul with the artwork. So there's tons of eye candy, but the stories are fascinating. It's like it's like an adventure in the lives of these incredible artists. So
hopefully that will be the future gift for Solari readers and subscribers.
Everybody's getting that book for Christmas.
But at the moment, let's go back to Barnes Foundation. And for those who are not familiar with either Dr. Barnes or the museum, maybe you, Catherine.
So I grew up on Dr. Barnes because my father was a surgeon at the University of Pennsylvania. He had gone to Penn Medical School. He was a surgeon at University of Pennsylvania and became the chairman of surgery at Pennsylvania. And Dr. Barnes had studied at the University of Pennsylvania. And after he graduated, he decided to become, he didn't want to be a doctor, he wanted to be a chemist. But all my life, the Barnes collection of art, which Barnes had collected after he'd made his fortune, which I'll describe what he did, it was very hard to get in and to get tickets and to get private showings. But if you were part of the University of Pennsylvania Medical School, you had an in. Mm-hmm. And so all my life as a child, I'd hear about Dr. Barnes and the collection and this fantastic, you know, and you were always like, Daddy, when can I finally see this? You know, so the anticipation of seeing the Barnes collection was many, many years coming for me. But it was something I grew up with. It was a part of my childhood. Anyway, Barnes had created a medicine that would help protect your eyes. And I don't begin to explain how it worked.
Silver
nitrate.
That till this day is protecting the eyes, especially it's given to newborn children to protect from gonorrhea, for example,
right,
or any other infection that can happen during the birth, for example.
Right. So. And Barnes sold his company literally a few months before the stock market crash.
In 1920.
So he sold it at the absolute high, got the money. He was married, but never had children. And so his money and so after he his the success of his company started to collect, he'd had a high school friend who plugged him into the Impressionists, and he started to collect fantastic amounts of the Impressionists. And that became his passion. Now, what I was taught as a child was that he was very uncomfortable with the Philadelphia art establishment and the Philadelphia Art Museum. And so he was insistent on keeping the collection very, very separate and keeping it in, he had had a mansion in Lower Merion, and he left it under the auspices of one of the universities in the area. And it's a long story, but if you look at the popularity of the collection, the place that where he had set it up and organized it could not handle the demand. And ultimately, there's a very famous documentary called The Art of the Steal about how the Philadelphia establishment engineered the breaking of the trust and the lawless movement of the Barnes Foundation down to the Parkway, where the Philadelphia Museum, the Rodin Museum, the Curtis Institute, all the art museums in Philadelphia are down there. So they plopped the Barnes Museum down. And dreadful as their behavior was, I will say this, it makes the collection much more accessible to a much greater group of people. And I think they did a beautiful job. They built a new building, and they absolutely kept the organization of the collection as he had, you know, had done it initially. So when you go and you see the collection, you're seeing it in a building that has far more light, far more parking, and is much more accessible. But it holds to the integrity of how he organized the collection.
Whereas to speak to that also, there is also another important aspect with any museum of fine art these days, is that if the collection is not held in a place that A, can be secured, because there's right. a lot of art theft. So if this is an older building that doesn't have proper security, it's very hard to protect it.
Right.
So that's one thing. And the other one is that because these paintings are over 100 years old, you need to keep them in the climate-controlled and light-controlled conditions. There is one of the paintings at the Barnes Foundation, which is the seminal painting of modern art, probably the most important painting. It's called The Joy of Life by Henri Matisse, which he has painted in, I think, 1906. The painting kind of launched the modern style of art to the mm-hmm. point that Picasso, as soon as he saw this painting, he just went home. First, he was quite pissed off that someone kind of stole his thunder, but then he went and started working on his Demoiselles of Avignon, mm-hmm. you know, the famous painting that is now at the Museum of Modern Art in New York. And those two paintings are basically the foundation, if you like, the pillars of the modern way of...
So they launched the Impressionist movement?
No, he launched the modern art.
Ah, okay.
The one that is kind of divorced from the need to represent something very realistic, maybe in the style of Impressionist, but still a realistic narrative story, and becomes just art for art. Mm-hmm. Joy of it, if you like, the color, the shape. It has been found recently, I think, 2015 or something like this, but recently in any case, in the 21st century, that the yellow that is in that painting, the mm-hmm. Joy of Life by Matisse, the yellow that he had used, which is, it's a sort of a cadmium yellow, is unfortunately losing the yellowness of it.
Wow.
Under the influence of light. The light is actually reacting with the yellow paint that was used by Matisse. So unless this painting is really protected, we will not have this painting in a few dozen years.
Right.
It will just bleach out completely. It has that yellow has sulfur, and the sulfur is reacting with oxygen in the air or something like this. So this is an argument for having the art housed in a purpose-built building that can actually protect paintings from, you know, the ravages of time, if you like.
Right.
And so this is I can just say, as a foreigner coming to Philadelphia, I felt like they did a remarkable job also in the architecture of fitting that huge building. It's like a very vast building into the whole street and into the whole district.
Right.
That it's. I think it's very well done.
I think so too. You know, it's unusual for me to say such glowing things about the Philadelphia establishment, but I think they did. I think they did an excellent job.
Mm-hmm. I think that we could maybe to just give an idea how unique this museum is in terms of, you know, the collection of Impressionist and Post-Impressionist art is to, maybe you can do that, to give a little statistics.
Okay, so Renoir, we have 181, which is why I love the barn so much, because I love the Renoir. Gauguin is 69, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah.
Yeah, Van Gogh is 7. Toulouse is...
several, I don't know how many.
Matisse is 59, Picasso 46, Modigliani 36. Wow.
No, that Modigliani is just several. I don't know how many exactly.
So Toulouse-Lautrec is several.
Okay. But the, you know, which museum has 181 works?
So in Paris, we were at, what's the Impressionist Museum?
The D'Orsay, yes.
Right. So D'Orsay, how many Renoirs do they have?
I don't know, but not that many, I think. I think right. Less.
Does anybody have 181 Renoirs?
Probably not. I mean, it is an amazing collection that he has to speak to the fact how he was, right. How this collection started, if you like. So in 1922, he has asked his childhood friend, as you said, Catherine, I think his name was William Glackers, who was also a painter, to go to Paris and help him start the collection. So the guy went to Paris and came back with 33 paintings. Which is fantastic. The moment the Barnes...
For 20,000. I mean, it's...
Yeah, that makes a deal after such... Anyway, so he goes there, buys those paintings, brings them back. Dr. Barnes takes a look at it, falls in love with all this. And within the same year, 1922, he goes to Paris twice and just starts buying like there is no tomorrow.
Right.
And he was able to... He was a fantastic negotiator. And very kind of astute in what he was choosing and how, why he was choosing. So he was able to choose some fantastic artworks that were already famous, already have been in some collections. And because of the generational change, the people who originally owned that, like, let's say, Gertrude Stein and her brother Leo Stein, have already gotten rid of the Joy of Life by Matisse, that it went to a dealer, and then Dr. Barnes was able to negotiate and purchase this painting. So he was at the perfect moment in Paris to buy the history of art, if you
will. But he bought them before the war, correct?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. 1922. This is where he was buying the majority of this fantastic... I mean, he has been buying artworks for many, many decades later. Right.
So he captured a moment just before it disappeared.
So it was after World War One and before World War Two.
Correct. That was the perfect moment. I mean, he has been buying. He died in 1951, so he has been buying throughout his life. But the mid 1930s, perfect moment to be buying art because of the generational change. You know, that something was collected, and then the families were, you know, getting rid of it. A lot of Monet paintings that he has bought them from the family because, you know, this was the time for them to be getting rid of them. So it was a perfect moment.
That's quite fascinating because it's also reflected in their works of art, as you are going to tell us that change of period, that change of, I think it's quite fascinating on how many levels there's transition in here.
Right. So this is the history of the fabulous Barnes Foundation. This is, to me personally, as I told you that when we were talking with Uli, that this is just like a candy store for me. It's like, oh, look at this. Oh, look at this.
Yes, and if I may say, if you walk with Nina through a museum like this, it's like we didn't want to spend so much time because we were going to another museum, but then the time just flew and so much... Nina is really an encyclopedia of art, walking on two legs, and just starting off talking is phenomenal.
When we went to all the Renoirs at the Rijksmuseum, do you remember that? Everybody was following it around. Everybody wanted to, you know, it looked like you were giving a tour because everybody was just following you. Yeah, they wanted to hear what you would say.
Yeah, at the Barnes, the lady who was a curator, I think, or guide, she was giving me an evil eye. It's just like, this competition, what is this woman doing? So that was that. But what I wanted to talk with the three of us, mm-hmm. three of us being some women, so that's maybe very useful in this case, about it, amongst those hundreds of paintings, the several paintings that kind of capture, or that the artists have captured, women doing something that is not being done anymore by women, meaning the world has changed, the lives of women have changed. Mm-hmm. It captures some occupations or activities of women that have basically changed because life has changed. And at the same time, there are beautiful paintings. Obviously, talking about paintings is not the same as showing them. We will show some of them at the Food for the Soul website so that you can refer to them looking at them, but I will give the titles of paintings and Willie, maybe you can describe them and we can talk about what has changed. So the first one that I was thinking we could talk about is Renoir's painting that is called The Family of the Artist, meaning his own family, in which he has five people. I'll just say which people they are. This is his wife, Aline Charigot, his older son, his younger son, the nanny, and then there is a girl who is a neighbor who is just basically there to complete the composition. So there's a nanny here. I want to talk about this. Or mm-hmm. you can talk about it.
Well, Catherine could talk about nanny.
Well, and you know, nannies exist today.
They do, yeah.
Yes.
But that's not as an institution in the family.
Correct, like because this is a bourgeois family, and mm-hmm. the kind of having a nanny available mm-hmm. was just like an obvious thing. There are children in the house. There will be a nanny to come with
right.
it.
Right.
These days, childcare is much more institutionalized just because, you know, there are not that many nannies around.
Right, but you still have nannies.
We still have nannies.
A lot of young women will go to another country mm-hmm. and travel.
The au pairs, yes.
The au pairs.
So that maybe hasn't changed much, but I think that this is also, you know, that this is nanny as a kind of organic part of mm-hmm. the family.
Yeah.
The nanny would come in and kind of stay for years, you know, the children would grow up with a kind of stability, especially Renoir. He was mm-hmm. always treating the ladies who, you know, the you know, maids or nannies that were in his family as members of the family.
Right.
He was very good about that. And of course, he portrayed them in many, many paintings.
Well, but the funny thing is, if you look at the thing I notice about Renoir is women are always beautiful. They're always interesting. They're always, you know, people, whenever you see a woman in Renoir, it's, ah, oh, that looks like an interesting person. That looks like somebody I'd like to know. They're appealing people. And Renoir makes women, you know, I think it's very revolutionary how appealing he makes women. But here's this picture, and the women all look appealing, and he doesn't. Have you noticed?
I think it's a nice observation, especially when we talk about other paintings later on,
yeah.
How the women are glowing from deep yeah. inside. And
yeah, so everybody's glowing except for Renoir.
They carry everything, it seems.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a beautiful, charming picture, and you're absolutely right. He was adamant that the reason he paints mainly children and women, you know, he did some male portraits, but only as, you know, commissioned portraits or portraits of his friends, but very few of them, because he said, that's the only thing I'm interested in painting. I'm interested in painting beauty, mm-hmm. and I find beauty in women and children because of the glowing skin and the,
right. it's
the
a
delicacy
glow.
Of
he feature. Always has this glow.
Yeah. And that's what he wanted. And he says, I'm not going to be apologetic about it. This is what I like. You know, mm-hmm. I am not like other artists who love to kind of paint mm-hmm. a seedy part of life. That wasn't him. He wasn't interested in that. This one is a painting by Edouard Manet. It's called Laundry, painted in 1875. And it portrays a woman who has a wooden bucket, a wooden bucket, and I don't even know if she has a washing board because this is a chair.
The bucket's on a chair.
And the bucket is on a chair, and then there's a little uh-huh. toddler who is helping her to do the wash. Mm-hmm. So obviously we all do the laundry these days, but we do not do the laundry like this anymore.
We used to do it in New Hampshire in a farm. That's exactly how we do the laundry.
Exactly. There used to be buckets and you were just doing it by hand and then hanging it on a string. But that doesn't happen anymore. We do have, there's something to be said for technology. You know, having a washer dryer, it just kind of makes life a little bit easier.
I don't know, but when you hang it on the line, it smells better.
So much better. Yeah. When the wind blows through it.
Yeah, I do that too. It is true, but I would rather, you know, that the machine did the first hard part. Because it is very, very hard work. In the 19th century, 20th century, whatever, but certainly in the 19th century, every household had so-called the laundry day,
where
everything, you know, not just a little shirt, but, you know, the bedding would be washed. And this was, you know, very hard work, you know, these acres and acres of fabric that had to be washed and dried and ironed and whatever.
It was your husband died and then you had to take in laundry.
That too.
Right.
Which is, and that, and then the guy was a happy man because then he could paint 37 paintings of the laundry women. But that's another story. So, but that has changed. This is capturing a moment that, you know, the laundry does not get done like this anymore. Here's a painting also by Renoir. It says that it's a woman doing crochet, which is something that is also a slightly passé type of activity.
Although I would point out, when we were driving from Ohio to the Hudson Valley, Carolyn was in the back seat crocheting.
Crocheting, not knitting?
Crocheting. I think it was crocheting. If you look at what she made like one of the pads you pick up the hot pan with, whatever.
Well, like it's still done as a hobby, but much less. But it is a beautiful painting, just showing something. You know, people usually these days just spend more time on the cell phone than, you know, with the crochet needle.
In Europe, you see this quite a lot. You still see people on the train, as you said. I also think of Doctors for COVID Ethics. There's this wonderful doctor, scientist, she's not a doctor, I think, Sabine Stäbel. And while she is on the meeting, meeting. And I see men in Europe.
Oh, really?
Yes.
How lovely.
That has been also almost a trend for more the green movement and for more ecological minded people. They were sitting there. Men were sitting there knitting their own jumpers or garments.
Knitting. If you know, you love Waldorf School and Rudolf Steiner and Montessori and all those philosophies.
Mm-hmm.
In that schooling, children of both sexes are taught to knit. And I don't know, at least 70, 100 years ago, boys and girls, they both were taught to knit. This was not gender-related kind of activity.
Something I never liked, by the way.
Knitting?
I never liked to
spend my entire childhood knitting. But, and there is another one here. This is painted by Claude Monet. He painted his wife. It's called Madame Monet Embroidering. What I find fascinating is that this is a painting in which you see this contraption on which she embroiders. It's almost like an easel for painting. It's a piece of furniture, if you like, on which you put the fabric and then you can embroider by sitting and doing it for hours. I mean, embroidering still happens a lot, but I don't see that furniture anymore. You know, it's not an activity that
it's we a beautiful have room. Painting.
All time. It's a very, well, now this is definitely an impressionistic painting with the light coming in. It looks like she's in a sunroom, probably, because that looks to me like there's glass behind. So maybe this is winter and the sun is coming in and they brought all the plants in for the winter. So she's like sitting in an indoor garden.
And that focus that she has and that like pouring herself into it. Yes, peace.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think just much less time that women have to sit and embroider.
Yeah, where's the piece gone?
Exactly. And this is something that definitely is not happening anymore. This is Renoir. And Renoir's painting saying entitled Woman Darning, meaning doing repairing.
Yeah, repairing the socks.
The socks, yes. We do not do that anymore.
No, out they go.
If a sock has a hole, we don't spend the time to darn. So this is the activity that definitely has gone away with the modern
But you
life.
Know what? Preparing for so many changes that we are, I still know how to do it.
Really?
School, no, yeah. I know how to yeah. do it as well. I was taught at school.
And it might even come in handy eventually.
Well, it does date us if we know how to darn.
it does.
But... Yeah, it has changed. You know, it is something that doesn't happen anymore. I find it kind of charming that there's such a painting here. And it is by your favorite. This is the painting that you, Uli, have loved so much. Mm-hmm. So maybe you can talk about it. I just introduced the title of it. It's Renoir's Mother and Child from 1881.
Mm-hmm. And I enjoyed it so much after you explained it, Nina, because you have this talent of pointing out things, and then suddenly you begin to notice those things. And as you were saying, many of the paintings in the Barnes Foundation collection are transitional on several levels of the meaning of transition, not just epochal, but also internally. And what we see here is this lovely young mother with a toddler, with a boy baby on her lap. And what is striking is that since we have been in 2019 to the Da Vinci exhibition, where we saw many of the Madonnas, look at the foot that she puts forward just a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And look at the blue of her garment, or of her, it's not a garment, but it's more like a jacket or a blouse and a apron. And also the boy, how he sits on her and how he has the finger at the mouth. This is so reminiscent of some of the Italian paintings of the Madonna and the child and Anna and the mother of.
And it's definitely on purpose.
Yeah.
What happened was that in 1881, Renoir finally had enough money to go to Italy, because he has come from modest beginnings and there was enough money for food and paid, much less traveling. But eventually he did have money. So he went to Italy after he has created many paintings already that were quite famous, the kind of seminal paintings of Impressionism. He went to Italy and he obviously started looking at Raphael and Michelangelo and Da Vinci.
So this is after he...
And after he came back, and he wrote about it in numerous letters, and he says, well, I was nothing. I didn't know how to paint. I didn't know anything about painting, which obviously is not true. But it was obviously something that impressed him enormously, the very fact that, you know, that there is a different way of painting. And obviously he fell in love with all those Madonnas. So... this is his painting that kind of corresponds to all the painting that he has seen, because the blue that you see on the girl's clothing is basically evoking the blue of the colour of the robe of Madonna. Of
the thing I love about this one is how active the boy looks.
Yes, he's kind of
he's
squirming.
All plump and squirming around, and he looks so lively. You know, but you give this feeling of liveliness, which is unusual.
It is absolutely charming painting. So, yes, he's drawing onto the huge tradition of, Renaissance Madonnas painted in Italy. But obviously he's making it a very modern painting. You know, she's sitting mm-hmm. in a chair. She's a nanny or a sister. She's holding a regular toddler
mm-hmm.
in contemporary clothes. So... he kind of makes this bridge. But also, Ulrike is absolutely right that many of the paintings that Dr. Barnes has collected are the transitional paintings from the point of view of the development of each of these famous artists. That they have used to do something, and then he collects the painting that kind of documents the new phase in their style or in their biography. They are excellent paintings to learn about the history of art, right. which is what his goal was.
And it's another example of how much he must have appreciated women and children, because you see, you elevate the everyday beauty into almost that theological beauty that he knows from Italy.
It's a joy, that painting. This is a painting by Amadeo Modigliani. Modigliani was an Italian artist who lived in Paris
died quite young of tuberculosis, so this kind of tragic life. He died at 37. And this is painted almost at the very end of his life. The painting is called Redhead Woman in Evening Dress and portrays his girlfriend at the time, Jean Ebuterne. But it's not named like this. It's just a woman in evening dress. What I like about this painting is, other than this, is if you like the art by Modigliani, which is kind of, you know, very flat, very modern, this is the new art, if you like, of where past impressionism, where even past post-impressionism, uh-huh. if you like. This is really a modern painting. We are, you know, this is like what Picasso was doing and then Cubists were doing. It's kind of flat surfaces. And if you, for example, look at her face, you know, he just does a few, almost like a pencil drawing, right? The eye is just like a black hole, if you like, and the nose is just like a line. Mm-hmm. This is a very modern art of painting. He knows that we all know what a face looks like. He doesn't need to render it in absolute photographic detail. There's photography for that. This is painted in 1918. Photography is there. We don't need that anymore, he says. Let's just look at the color and shape and the elegance of this woman. In terms of transition, what I like about it as well is that this is, as a modern painting, this is no longer a commissioned portrait of an aristocrat who just, you know, had enough money to pay to have his beautiful, formal portrait for her dining room painted. This is not... what Impressionists did a lot is the paintings of the models who were usually prostitutes who, you know, for a few francs were just posing in order to make a living. It is a painting of a modern woman who happens to be a girlfriend of the artist, but it's just basically a model whom he uses. So this is the role of a mm-hmm. of a woman model has also changed. Mm-hmm. This is not a paid for commissioned portrait. Nobody paid him to paint it. And this is not, you know, painting the desperate women in the streets, because no self-respecting woman would ever pose to a painter, you know, for a painting. It was just like, he must be crazy. I'm not going to do that. So there's a change of a role mm-hmm. of a woman on a portrait, right? It's a different kind of a portrait. So I like that. Mm-hmm. And now we should talk about favorites.
Yes. So I have a game I play whenever I go to a museum, and that is I get to pretend that I can take one painting home, and I have to choose which one. And it sounds easy. It's not. It's very hard.
Not at Barnes. It's very difficult. There's too many of them.
So now this is the one I would take home. And I have this as a screensaver on my laptop.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I'll since nobody can see that painting, I'm going to name it. So this is Renoir's painting called Reading from about 1891. And it shows two girls, I would say they're about, I don't know, 10 years old, 12 max, maybe a little bit younger, who are sitting next to each other looking at something that they are reading together.
And I used to have an etching by Renoir called was two sisters sitting on a beach, or two young girls sitting on a beach. And I eventually gave it to my sister. But it reminds me a little bit of that etching. But I just love how they're doing this together. It's just, and it's, you know, you see these two beautiful girls and they're just engrossed in reading together. And it has this wonderful energy.
And it has those beautiful glowing colors because one of the girls is wearing a pink dress, the other one, a white one. They have kind of reddish blonde hair. The sun is reflecting off this hair. So this is like a glow that emanates from them, which is also the glow of youth to a great extent. Mm-hmm. You know, they're very young girls, and it's just there's innocence and mm-hmm. radiating purity, if you like, mm-hmm. that is not easy to capture. I mean, it's easier to describe than to actually capture in a painting.
But he does. Nice painting. He captures.
Well, he does.
That's why he's Renoir. But I'm just saying, it's easier to say than it's like, yeah, you think that? Well, then go and paint it, right?
Mm-hmm. Many of them tried and not that many of them successfully. So this is your favorite painting mm-hmm. called Reading.
Uli, you have chosen a very fantastic painting, which I will name first, right? Okay, and then you can talk about it. So it's by Henri Matisse. It's called The Three Sisters Triptych, because there's three paintings, very large size, you know, like from floor to ceiling size next to each other. It was painted in 1917, and it's probably the pièce de résistance, you know, the masterful treasury of Barnes Foundation. I mean, it's a major artwork in that collection.
So you think if we were to price all the art out, that would be one of the most valuable pieces?
Yes, and there's a story to that, but I'll tell you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we were playing that game that Catherine asked all of us, and Ricardo was with us also, to go through the museum. And I was almost picking the one that you had. I resonated a lot. But then you go upstairs, and suddenly you see this. And for me, it was clear. It's not one painting. It's a triptych, as you said. It's three paintings. It's very tall, and it's just breathtaking. There is three different panels of each one portraying three sisters or three women. And it's, as Nina pointed out, the center one is almost like a normal portrait where each of the figures is looking to the observer or to the painter. But the other two on the left and then to the right, they are, again, it's almost like exploding or changing the format or the idea of what is a portrait. While the left one is, there is no actual point of view or eye-catching perspective, because each of the figures is turning it to a different direction. Their eyes are looking somewhere else. The right one is almost like a momentum of motion that could have been captured on a camera, where someone is turning around and the people are looking almost with surprise at the observer or at the painter. But what is so fascinating to me is that progression of color and of motion that goes through this whole the three triptych. And so there's this powerful green of it's a spring green and variations of it, and then this violet, or how would you call this, mm-hmm. purple color. And each of the paintings have the same colors in a sense, but in a different distribution. And it's I think it's just really it's complete. It's really, really powerful, and so much light in it.
Yes. So just to speak to you about mm-hmm. the paintings, after he has painted those paintings, they got separated. They were sold
really?
To different. Yes, they were sold to different clients. And Dr. Barnes spent a lot of time tracking those paintings and finally reuniting them.
Wow.
And putting them together. He did invite Matisse at some point to decorate part of the foundation buildings, to do frescoes of the dancing women.
Mm-hmm.
And when finally Matisse arrived with the frescoes, you know, the commissioned work, he saw those three paintings finally reunited and he was transported, because you know, it was the dream for him. He painted something as Ulrich has beautifully described, as a certain narration story mm-hmm. and variation on a theme. There is an intellectual, conceptual thought behind those three paintings. That's why mm-hmm. it's called the triptych. He's doing something with those three paintings, and then they got separated. And thanks to Dr. Barnes, they got reunited in one gallery, and they are next to each other in the order that he has designated, the artist designated. So there's a story to that, you know.
Right.
This not that easy for the paintings to be together. There is another triptych that he has painted in 1906, 1911, I think, or something like this, when a collector called Ivan Morozov, who was a Russian collector who bought a lot of Matisse, one of the first collectors of Matisse works, and his patron, if you like, thanks to Matisse, kind of exited the abject poverty and started painting more. So Morozov has sent him to Morocco, to Tangiers, to paint things for him. He paid for this trip. So over there, Matisse painted three paintings, which are blue in color, that show morning, noon, and evening. Three paintings inside the room that show the different kind of light.
Right.
Beautiful paintings. Unfortunately, after Morozov has escaped Russia during the revolution, or right after the revolution, his collection stayed with Soviet Union, if you like. And for various reasons, money and power, as it usually happens, the three paintings got separated. I've had a chance to see them reunited for the only time when they were shown in Paris at the retrospective of Ivan Morozov collections in 2019, I think. But after that, they went back to Russia and they are separated again. And they probably will stay separated forever because they're in three different museums. That's what I'm trying to say.
Right.
So thanks to Dr. Barnes, at the Barnes Foundation, you can not only see one of the most exquisite works by Henri Matisse ever, but also they are in the right way, not separated. So perfect place, Enrique. Beautiful. You chose the best.
So, unbeknownst.
No, it speaks to you. That's why. Mm. It's not unbeknownst. It's because this is exactly what good art is. It just speaks to people the way it should speak to people. Mm. That's what I believe, at least. So I had a hard time to choose because I love them all, of course. Mm-hmm. But let's say that I chose this and then I can show something because we will have to finish with Cézanne. But let me just talk about this painting of Matisse because we started the subject. It's also by Matisse. It's called
The Music Lesson.
The Music Lesson. There's two, actually, it's not exactly that because there's two paintings called The Music Lesson and this one is also The Music Lesson, but it's also The Family. And it shows four people in the room, the painting from 1917. And in that painting, you see his almost grown-up son, Matisse's almost grown-up son, who was, it is 1917, and he already got the orders to go to war, the First World War, to the front. So he's about to leave. The younger son is doing the music lessons, sitting at the piano and learning. The woman next to him is Marguerite, who was Matisse's oldest daughter from a different liaison, if you like. He was not married to her mother, but she was living with a family all her life. And the person at the very back that almost looks like a man, it's very small. She's sitting in a rocking chair and working on some embroidery, is actually Amélie, his wife. But she's so small and so far away that you can barely tell who that is. Matisse himself, because this is the family, is present in this painting in two ways. First of all, there's this violin at the very front. And that violin kind of signifies Matisse because he put violin in many of the paintings that kind of a stand-in for himself. He played violin all his life. He was very good at it. He was always at some point hesitating whether he should become a musician or a painter.
Mm-hmm.
Thank God, you know, we're lucky that he decided to be a painter. Because I don't know if he would be a good musician, but he was certainly a great painter. And he, in the garden, you see a large figure of one of the sculptures that he did, which is a kind of a nude of a woman. And that sculpture is pretty big and dominating. So he's kind of present in that painting through those two things. This is the time when he's
family became very dysfunctional, meaning there was kind of a breakdown of his relationship with his wife. His older son was going into the army and nobody knew what's going to happen. Marguerite was always a problem because she was not well. So, she was not married and she would never get married. If you look at this painting, none of the people in this family are looking at each other or relating to each other that much. Everybody's somewhere else. And certainly the wife is kind of pushed to the very back and kind of dominated by the sculpture of Matisse. So there is a lot of, kind of tension, interaction and unspoken things. To me, it's a portrait of a modern family, which very often, for various reasons, is...
They're scattered from each other.
Scattered, not functional, not relating to each other or relating with difficulty. At the same time, it's a beautiful painting if you look at the colors. That's something good. That you love.
Yes.
Right? I mean, maybe you can speak to colors.
Totally. Yeah, you see that, again, this green is simply captivating in the background. And then it's reflected on the musical note. Of Brahms music, and also the brown and the orangey that is reflecting. It's the composition is just exquisite. And didn't this figure appear in other paintings of his?
It does appear in other paintings. There's a small model he made of this nude, and then he made a big one as well. And it kind of is a stand-in for his sculptural work, if you like. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of clues in this painting. This is a painting that you can teach art history from it, or you can just sit and enjoy and look at it, or have, a reproduction of this painting as a screensaver or something, and just look at it. But it's one of the paintings that if you ever go to Barnes' collection, that triptych and this painting is probably completely unmissable because it brings so much joy. And I challenge anybody to understand how incredibly talented Matisse was in terms of...
So this is talent. The one you would take home?
That's the one I would take home if they would like me, yes. However, my other great love than Matisse is Cézanne. I was never right about them in Food for the Soul because we don't have access to images that much because they're modern painters. But my other huge love is Cézanne.
Right.
And it was probably Dr. Barnes' love as well, because there's enormous amount of exquisite Cézanne works in that collection.
So our banker came with us, and this was his choice to take home.
That was his choice, because he got fascinated by the very fact that what Cézanne did, that's what I was kind of facetiously saying when we were looking at this painting, that the art in art history, there's art before Cézanne and after Cézanne, meaning after he kind of burst into a scene at some point and started creating his works, which were completely ridiculed and unrecognized for many, many years by the public, not by the painters. Every of the major painters who was contemporary of his had in their collections a lot of Cézanne paintings because they knew that his art is something special. And they were buying his art long before anybody else. Most of them had to eventually get rid of it. Yeah. There was, who was that? I think it was Gauguin who had bought one painting by Cézanne. That was his biggest treasure. And he said, I will only sell it if I'm in complete dire straits. Eventually he was in dire straits many, many decades later. And he had to sell his Cézanne, but it was the most treasured possession of Gauguin, was a Cézanne painting. The same way as Matisse and Cézanne are the two painters that, first of all, are incredible colorists. They're painters in art who are very good about line design. Da Vinci is a perfect example of that. Botticelli, masters of disegno, as they used to say in Renaissance Florence. The shapes, the line, the drawing. Matisse and Cézanne are the people who are the masters of color, and you can test it by trying to color in a Cézanne or Matisse painting and see how difficult it is to gather those colors and have them work with each other. You have to have the talent that either you have it, you don't. So that's one thing that it is. This is the still life that I love, that I'm using as an example. You made many. Most people probably, if they ever have heard of Cézanne, they're familiar with his apples and mm-hmm. pears in various, and he did a lot of still lives of apples and pears. This is one of them. What is the most striking thing for you when you look at this painting? What is that it's like?
Well,
something
I'm
is strange.
I'm actually corrupted or spoiled by your knowledge that you gave to us. But something that is striking is the perspective, mm-hmm. The various types of perspectives that built into this picture. Normally we would expect or a realistic painting would have a realistic perspective, but here we have probably three or maybe even four perspectives. If you look at the background, if you look at the right hand side, it angles downwards, and this is quite striking. And of course, again, for me, the colors here as well. Catherine, what strikes you in this?
So what strikes me is totally different. It reminds me of a world I used to live in.
Helter Skelter, slightly.
No, but beautiful draperies. Yes. I used to have a brown velvet. My dining room was in a brown velvet
uh-huh.
that was a patterned brown velvet that looks just like this. And things were very beautiful, and we had lovely food, and we had lovely china.
Yes.
It's all very beautiful.
He takes all those elements. He does, as Ulrika says, use different perspectives, because he's basically saying that when we look at objects, we look at them from different point of view,
mm-hmm.
because we move, our eyes move,
mm-hmm.
our body moves as well. So we are not in this static, this is my point of view, and this is like everything looks. He says, no. This is not how the human eye and human brain works. You look at things from within seconds. You look at objects slightly different. So he's
right,
trying to put it all in
what
here.
It talks to me about is abundance.
Uh huh.
Yes.
It's about abundance. You know, the beauty of the background and the drapes and the fruit and the vase, and it's all about, there's plenty for everybody. Come and get it.
And doesn't it radiate also the health
mm-hmm.
and of the? There's no genetically manipulated apples in there. You can actually
right.
see
everything
it.
Everything is. So it's
vibrant.
Not surprising that our banker would choose it, because he's a wealth builder and it's a building wealth.
Mm-hmm. And everything is vibrant, and what
yeah.
do apples symbolize? This symbolize
yeah.
health and
it's an abundant. It's an abundant world.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So I cannot not talk about Cézanne when I said talk about favorite paintings, but anybody who's going to go to the collection at any point will find something for themselves, whether this is going to be.
Well, now you know why we use brown velvet on our dining room.
Absolutely. The colors work. This is
uh-huh.
sumptuous, I would say. That's the probably good word.
Mm-hmm.
In a good way, right? It's something that nourishes the soul, which is what we are
mm-hmm.
about, right? Food
yes.
for the soul. I think we have run out of time to talk about, and it's very hard to talk about art in general, because it's better to look at art than talk about it. But we just wanted to share with everybody our enjoyment and sense of wonder when you spend an hour or two just looking at paintings and being reminded that art is necessary in our life just to transport it to something.
Beauty is necessary for survival. All I can say is if you are traveling to Philadelphia, or if you live in Philadelphia and you haven't been to the Barnes Museum, it's a little bit like living in Memphis and not going to Graceland. Do you know what I mean?
And also, if you've enjoyed this, listening to Nina's explanations, the book,
Women in Art, will come this year. We'll certainly let you know when it comes out. And it celebrates all the great columns you've written about women. And anyway, so it was it was very interesting when I tried to persuade you to come to Barnes. So this is the third year I've tried to persuade you to come to Barnes, and finally you came.
So. And I'm so happy that I did. Thank you very much for having me in Philadelphia.
I think it's shocking that I introduced Nina Hine to an artistic experience. So, you know, it just goes to show you there's an exception to everything.
No, it goes to show that you're never, a prophet in your own country or something like that. You should humbly just basically listen to the locals as well, I guess. But we had a wonderful time, that's for sure.
And I just have to mention one thing that that Ricardo said yesterday, because you and Ricardo were going to record an interview on your experience. He said in his life, he can divide his life between two phases, pre-Nina Hine and after Nina Hine. Well, but here's the thing. You have this immensely talented young man who was never introduced to art in his life. And so he and his wife are Dutch, and they had never been to the Rijksmuseum or the Van Gogh Museum. And off he goes to the Rijksmuseum with you, and it's a revolutionary experience.
And a positive experience, meaning he was happy and he discovered. And the interesting thing is that for him, because he was at the museum as well, unfortunately he cannot join us today, his favorite paintings were none of these impressionist, you know, women darning or whatever, which I can totally understand. But he discovered an artist he didn't know about, Giorgio De Chirico, who is the Italian symbolist most active during the First World War, you know, the kind of period of 1911 to 1920 is probably the best paintings of his. And these are surrealist paintings of strange architecture and strange cities and people in a strange landscape, kind of similar to René Magritte's later paintings or paintings from the same time.
He loved them.
And that's what was his discovery.
Uh-huh.
And that's what I believe that art museums are. You just go there without any preconception. You just go there.
Everybody needs to know what they would take home.
Yes, and that's what we recommend to everybody.
Go find the art that you would take home. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, this has been a pleasure. Check out the other great Food for the Soul podcasts. We have a whole selection of both audios and videos on the Food for the Soul website, along with great columns on both Nina's museum trips and wonderful movies. You vote for the Academy Awards. So you see
how many,
600 movies a year.
No, maybe 300, but.
Okay, 300 a year. But this is your first beginning of your Food for the Soul year. And you have many more museums to come this year. Give us just a quick 2 seconds on the schedule.
Well, not the schedule, maybe, but we certainly will be covering a big exhibition of Caspar David Friedrich, Romantic German Painters Retrospective in Berlin, and big exhibition called The Birth of Impressionism in Paris at Musée d'Orsay.
You're going to have lunch in that great lunchroom? Okay.
Thinking of you because I'm going along.
Okay.
And there is an exhibition at Tate in London, which is called Now You See Me, Women Artists from 1520 to 1920, which kind of speaks to the theme of our book. So there's three big exhibitions that I definitely will try to report on.
Okay.
That are coming up in the next few months.
Okay, so ladies and gentlemen, stay tuned on the Food for the Soul website. Thank you for joining us on Food for the Soul at Soleri Report. And thank you, Nina Hine.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Ulrike, for joining us as well.